Chapter 20. Nicole, 6 months ago. The day after Ray and Janice returned from Baton Rouge, she told him, "I'm going to see what kind of favors I can call in." He thought she'd already called in every favor she could to get him into festivals and masterclasses, but apparently her connections ran deeper. They didn't discuss it, but he thought she was shocked by his spending the night in jail. Perhaps it reminded her that black people struggled not only in the music world, but in America as a whole. A few days later, Janice reached out while he was practicing. "Hi, do me a favor and put your violin down." "Why? Is something wrong?" His pulse immediately started hammering in his temples. "Have you put the violin down?" "Hold on a sec." He put the violin down. "Yes, it's down. What's wrong?"
"Do you have anything booked yet for December 3rd?
"Jeez, you scared me." He had a masterclass at Ohio State University in Columbus.
"You're going to need to cancel that."
"Why? What's going on?"
"I just got a confirmation that on December 13th, you'll be soloing with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Riccardo Muti."
Ray had clearly misheard. The Chicago Symphony Orchestra was arguably the top orchestra in the world. It was certainly in the top five. Riccardo Muti held two directorships, one in Chicago and one in Italy. He was perhaps the best-known conductor in America. A multiple Grammy winner, he also promoted diversity in every program he developed. If this was affirmative action, if Ray was getting ahead only because he was black, then he'd take it. This was the opportunity of a lifetime, possibly of several lifetimes.
"How the hell did you do that?" "Charm and wit, my dear. And a whole lot of promises we gotta keep. This is gonna be fun."
A month before the Chicago Symphony performance, Ray would be playing an afternoon recital at Carnegie Hall. Janice tamped down his expectations. It wasn't an evening performance, and it was one of the smaller auditoriums, and there probably wouldn't be a lot of people in the audience. But it was still Carnegie Hall, one of the most famous concert venues in the world. But 2 days before Carnegie Hall, Ray had been booked to play with the Erie Philharmonic. Janice charitably called it an aspirational orchestra. He took a late flight, and the orchestra's town car deposited him at the auditorium just in time to catch the run-through of Tchaikovsky's March Slav. The orchestra had clean technique and seemed very well prepared. He was used to the drill now. He met with the orchestra, ran through the rehearsal, did his solo with the Tchaikovsky concerto. Halfway through the second movement, the conductor stopped, as he'd done several times already, and as was typical in these rehearsals.
"Okay. Violas," he said, "this isn't working. We need more finesse in your melodic line here. It's very choppy."
On the first stand in the viola section, a young woman with auburn hair and wide-set hazel eyes was nodding almost before the conductor got the words out.
"You're absolutely right," she said, turning around to the violas behind her. "We need to imitate what Mr. McMillan's doing. Play it in the upper part of the bow."
She demonstrated, the phrase pouring out beautifully, elegantly.
"That's exactly right," the conductor said.
Ray agreed. The rehearsal continued, Ray finishing his solo. Then they took a break, and he met individual orchestra members, all of whom seemed elderly, many of whom wanted to see his violin. And then he found himself in front of the second chair viola, the young woman who'd spoken up earlier. Her left arm had a single eighth note tattoo right above her wrist. She had a seriously athletic body, too.
"You destroyed that Tchaikovsky," she told him. "I don't think I've ever heard it played that fast."
"You like that?" He had trouble meeting her eyes. He didn't know why.
"I certainly did. Nice work."
"Thanks. I'm Ray."
Kind of figured. I'm Nicole. I'm in the viola section. Yeah, I noticed you. I mean, I saw you there. Ray McMillan, suave ladies' man.
Well, I noticed you, too. Kind of rare to have a cute violinist around here.
He had never actually played with someone his own age, someone attractive of the opposite sex, someone who was in many ways his equal. His mind started spinning, and he was unable to rein it back. Why did she have to live in Erie, Pennsylvania, of all places? What was her name again? Natalie? Natasha? Should he give her his card? Was that too pretentious? He suddenly started getting visions of taking her out to dinner, going for long walks on a beach, holding hands. Did Erie have a beach? Wasn't it near a lake? So what do you do around here? He asked. She looked him up and down.
I'm doing it. I play music.
Mercifully, the conductor, Kevin Fiore, called the orchestra back to continue rehearsal. Ray was done for the night, which fortunately meant he was done making a complete idiot of himself.
What's your name? I'm Nicole, remember? I told you a couple seconds ago.
Right, my bad.
I'll see you tomorrow. Get some rest. You look like you could use it.
Ray went back to the hotel in a daze. The performance would go fine, he thought. That Nicole, though. Damn. Not only was she pretty, but she played well. And she thought he was cute. Ray was beside himself. College had been a single-minded pursuit of music. And although he'd gone out a few times with a few girls, he'd always been more focused on playing than being in a relationship. It didn't help either that all the women at school had been white and that they had somehow seemed off bounds to him. And after graduation, of course, he'd been swept up in the whirlwind of the Strad. Now he couldn't get the image of that young woman's hazel eyes and eighth note tattoo out of his head. Later, at the Shea Center for Performing Arts, he warmed up in his dressing room. The yellow walls seemed to shine in approval as the sounds of the Tchaikovsky concerto bounced off them. He was ready. Tonight's performance wasn't for the 1,000 patrons that came to hear him. It wasn't just another warm-up for Chicago. It was for Nicole. He shook his head. How could a 45-second conversation make him feel this way? When Glinka's Ruslan and Ludmilla overture began, he headed up to the stage, lurking in the wings for a glimpse of her. A delicate gold chain around an elegant neck, below a dark red French braid. When he finally came on stage, he did everything he could to avoid looking at Nicole, but she caught his eye anyway, lifted one pencil-thin eyebrow. He nodded imperceptibly, an upward tilt of his chin, and focused on the conductor, the shaking of hands, the brief bow. For a moment, he thought of giving her the pink rose. Why was he such an idiot? He should have brought two. But instead, scurried off stage, handing the rose to a 12-year-old girl sitting in the third row. The night's Tchaikovsky concerto bloomed full of energy, and he followed it with the Massenet encore. He was playing so easily, so comfortably, that he dared to let his head turn to the first stand in the viola section. Nicole was smiling as she played and looking at him. And then he lost his place. Couldn't remember at all what came next. He'd been playing from memory and had not bothered to even bring out his music. Janice, as usual, had been right. All the recitals and concerts under his belt kept him from panicking now. He felt the conductor's glare and picked up at the next phrase. After the curtain call, while the players were mingling, he searched for Nicole but didn't see her. He looked for her backstage, lingered in the dressing room, thinking she'd find him. The conductor came in, shook his hand, led him to the back door and a town car outside, where 2 dozen people were waiting for him to autograph their programs.
"Glad I got to hear you today.
one elderly man told him. You're going somewhere. I'll be able to say I knew you when.
Nicole wasn't outside, though. Where had she gone so quickly? He hadn't given her his card, and now it was too late to go back inside. He signed every program, waiting for her to appear. He could email Kevin Fiore about her, he supposed, but that seemed too intense. Maybe she was listed on the orchestra's website, and he could track her down through social media. Would that make him look like a creep? Besides, he reminded himself, she lived in Erie, Pennsylvania. Who knew when he'd be back? Long-distance relationships never worked. An itinerant musician on his way up the musical ladder didn't have time for a relationship anyway. What was he thinking? He had to get a hold of himself. Relationship? He didn't even know her last name. Why was he thinking about a relationship? Enough. He would put the eighth note and the auburn hair behind him. Goodbye, Erie, Pennsylvania. Good riddance. Back in New York, he always stayed at the same hotel, the Saint-Jacques, where Janice had booked them when they'd flown in to have the violin authenticated. Despite his first experience there, it was familiar. He'd requested it from Carnegie Hall, and luckily it was on their list. After checking into his room, which went off without a hitch, queen-size bed and a view of Midtown, Ray showered and curled up in bed. He couldn't fall asleep right away, brooding about the girl back in Erie. Nicole. Why hadn't he gotten her last name? He needed to focus. Carnegie Hall, this was his big chance, and he couldn't mess it up. Time to leave Erie, Pennsylvania, behind. Ray got out of bed, attached the practice mute to the violin, and played for the next hour and a half. He must have practiced the same up-bow staccato run in the Defia for 40 minutes. The constant repetition soothed him, and he fell asleep, thinking only passingly of Nicole. The next day, Ray arrived at Carnegie Hall 3 hours before showtime. He took a moment to look around at all the splendor that surrounded him. The gilt, the crystal chandeliers, the famous stage. Backstage, his feet walked were the feet of some of the greatest musicians, Yasha Heifetz, Yehudi Menuhin, Gil Shaham, Itzhak Perlman, once walked. He introduced himself to his accompanist, an older woman named Grace, who did not seem particularly happy to be there. Normally during a recital, the soloist calls the shots, setting tempos, figuring out timing, and so forth. Grace, however, knew better than Ray. She made it a point to let him know how many big-name performers she had accompanied. Ray thought better of asking her what the soloists were like to work with. Instead, he just smiled and told her, "This movement needs to go faster. I appreciate that you're holding true to the set tempo, but I'll be playing it much faster. If that's going to be an issue, we can see about finding another accompanist for this piece. I'd much rather have you play with me, of course. I can't wait to add my name to your distinguished list." Grace relented, and the rest of the rehearsal went more smoothly. An hour later, Carnegie Hall began to come to life. Soon, the 250-plus seat auditorium was nearly full. The New York music scene was eager to learn just who this Ray McMillan was. Tickets had sold out shortly after Ray's performance was announced. Claude Gilliam, the executive artistic director, introduced him. The moment came. The crowd rustled expectantly, and Ray walked onto the stage, bowed. Applause. Handed out the pink rose to an elderly woman halfway up the right aisle. More applause. Defia's Spanish dance was energetic, but also languid and sensual, with a deep romantic passion. The music was originally part of an opera in which a gypsy girl, for an instant as he visualized the music in his head, the gypsy girl reminded him of someone, Nicole, fell in love with a man above her social class. Ray had played this piece several times for his grandmother, and she'd loved it.
Now it felt like a fitting tribute to her, but also to the violin. His pizzicati were forceful and bold, passionate and rich. His nerves fell away, and the rich acoustics of the room took over, thundering around him. Seemingly moments after he'd raised his violin to begin, he was taking his bow, holding out the violin for its own adoration. On to the encore, Massenet's Meditation from Thais. Perhaps standard encore fare, but Ray loved this piece, a lyrical gem that starts off with nostalgic yearning, plummets to insecure agony, and then triumphs with peace and joy. He poured himself into the song's desperation, its dark misery, its sunlit final passages. Too soon, the last harmonic rang out, and he kept his bow on the string until the final echoes blurred away. The audience was silent. He lowered the violin. The audience rose to its feet. He had done it. He shook Grace's hand. The crowd came up on stage to meet him, congratulate him. It was one of those moments that he honestly couldn't believe was happening. Finally, just before 7 p.m., he slipped out the rear door onto 7th Avenue. A huge crowd waited for him, and he signed programs.
"Not bad for your first time, cutie," said a familiar voice.
Nicole, her dark auburn hair loose around her face. He couldn't help himself. He grinned. He could feel himself lighting up. "Hey," he said. At first he tried to sound casual, but he quickly just gave in.
"What are you doing here?" "I figured it would be stupid of me not to witness Ray McMillan's Carnegie Hall debut. I expect to be telling my grandkids about this. You were incredible, by the way. The way you played Defia was insanely good. The spiccatos on your arpeggios were really impressive. I don't think I ever saw your bow leave the string. I honestly don't know how you did it."
"I really appreciate that," he said. Many people had complimented him on his arpeggios, but none of them was gorgeous or made his heart hammer in his ribcage the way she was doing. He liked it. A lot. The moment stretched. What was he doing? Why was he so terrible at talking to this woman? She was violin-shaped, right? So why was this so hard? "You staying in town?"
"I got this sick deal," she said enthusiastically. "Amtrak is so expensive, but I figured out a way from New Rochelle that's like half the price. It doesn't leave till 9:30, though. That gives me time for dinner. I've already seen the show."
"Yeah, I saw it too," he said. "No, wait. I was there." Smooth, Ray. "Glad you liked it." He looked for something to lean against, but it was just him, this woman, and the sidewalk.
"Look," she said. "You want to grab dinner?"
"Me?" he said. Sometimes he honestly could not believe the stupidity that poured from his mouth. "Yeah, I'd love to."
"Good," she said, and confidently headed a few blocks over to a tiny Indian place on the second floor of a building above a wig shop.
It was cheap, and some of the best food Ray had ever had in his life. They talked about music and orchestras, about her growing up in a middle-class family that didn't quite understand her love of music, but didn't actively try to thwart it the way Ray's mother had.
"The worst thing is that it always felt like there was that one kid who always played better than me, you know?" she said. "The one who always got the private lessons and always got the solo at the end-of-year concert."
"I know exactly what you mean. For me, it was this one guy. Mark Jennings. Racist asshole, but he had seriously fast fingers," Ray said. He hadn't thought about Mark Jennings for years. Did he still play?
"Kyle Rasmussen. I hated Kyle Rasmussen."
She laughed. Her experiences mirrored his own. She could understand him.
She was a performer like him. She was a musician. Even without her figure and her great laugh, he would have picked her out of a crowd. How could he make this into something more than just dinner? More than just, maybe, a one-nighter? He toyed with his vegetable tikka masala and wondered if he could move to Erie. It had an airport, right? He didn't need to be in Charlotte. But it didn't seem like she'd be in Erie for long anyway. Erie was her first gig out of college, but she was ambitious. She'd been doing some substitute viola work in the Cleveland Orchestra, for starters, and that might lead to something more permanent. She really liked Cleveland. It had a vibrant musical scene. "I've also been volunteering there," she confided, as if it were a secret. "Doing what?" "There's a program where we play music in soup kitchens. First, you serve the guests, and then you serenade them. It's pretty awesome. I'm way better with the viola than I am with the mashed potatoes, though." "Wow," he said. "That sounds really awesome. I'd love to do that sometime." "You should come," she said casually. "I'd love to," he said. "We just have to figure out when. Let me know when you're there, and I'll rearrange my schedule." Yes! He had an excuse to see her again. He'd impress her with how well he could ladle out the gravy to pour over her mashed potatoes. 2 hours flew by. Nicole glanced at her watch. "Oh, man, I've got to get going. The Metro North train leaves in like 25 minutes. There is a desolation like none other when a beautiful woman sitting across from you has to catch a train in 25 minutes. This was a far cry from eating alone in a hotel restaurant or picking up some fast food takeout and gulping it down in his room. "Isn't there a later train?" "Not for the $23 I found," she said. She pulled out her phone, thumbed through a couple apps. "There's another at 6:32 a.m. for $32, but I don't want to sit in the Poughkeepsie train station for 3 hours. "Oh," he said. "Plus, where would I hang out for the night?" she said. The energy pulsed between them. "I guess I could take the train at 12:32, she said. "It costs $46, though." "I think you should. We can grab a nightcap." "Yeah, sure. If you want." They headed back to the Sanjak. Mike held the door for them. "How did the concert go?"
"Pretty good," Ray said.
Nicole said, "He was terrific."
"Sorry I missed it."
"Thanks, Mike," Ray said. Nicole smiled, grabbed Ray's arm, and led him to the hotel bar. 3 beers later, it was almost 11:45 p.m., and time for Nicole to head to Grand Central for the train.
"I wish you didn't have to go," he said.
"I don't," she said. Before he could mess up the situation, she leaned over the table, bumping into one of the beer glasses, and kissed him. The kiss lasted a very long moment. He stood, reflexively swinging the violin case onto his back. "How would you feel if I asked you to come up to my room?" he said.
"I would feel like, what took you so long to ask me?" she said.
He led her to the elevator. At 5 a.m., he woke up to an empty bed, turned on the light. Her clothes were gone. He sat up, pressed his back against the padded ivory headboard. He knew it was too good to be true. She was gone. There's no way a pretty girl like that could be interested in him. He dove back under the covers just as the room door clicked open. She was back, carrying 2 coffee cups and a brown paper bag.
"Hey,
morning," Ray said. Nicole sat the items down and kissed Ray.
He worried about morning breath, but she didn't seem to mind.
Morning, handsome. Sorry to wake you up. I was hoping I'd be back before you noticed I was gone.
I thought I ditched you, right? She grinned.
Not a chance. I picked up an early breakfast for us. I have got to catch my train at 6:32, though.
Oh.
I hope you like egg on an everything bagel.
Oh, man. You actually remembered that?
Of course I did.
Here, this one's yours. She handed him one of the coffee cups. It was cool. Orange juice. He told her last night that he didn't drink coffee. He took a swig, kissed her again.
How much time do we have? I need to leave here in 45 minutes, tops.
Plenty of time, he said. Later that morning, hours after she'd left and he'd fallen back asleep, his phone rang. A 212 number he didn't recognize.
Mr. McMillan?
I'm David Talbot. I'm an executive producer at 60 Minutes. I was in the audience yesterday afternoon at Carnegie Hall, the man went on. I was very impressed. That was a sold-out crowd. Not bad for a Thursday afternoon recital.
I guess they liked my playing.
Which is why I'm calling. I wonder if you'd be interested in having us do a piece about you. I've been following your career for a while, and yesterday's performance wasn't an anomaly. We'd like to explore that on the show.
So,
Ray said, took a breath, and said again,
So, you want me to be on 60 Minutes?
He tried to wrap his head around the conversation.
Yes, we do.
Chapter 21. 60 Minutes, 5 months ago. 20 minutes until he performed with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. The Chicago Symphony Orchestra. He thought his head might explode. He'd asked Anderson Cooper, when he met Anderson Cooper and Anderson Cooper had introduced himself as Anderson Cooper, Ray thought he was having an out-of-body experience, and the cameraman to give him a minute. Now it was just him and the violin and the panic that was threatening to overwhelm him. Nicole had flown in and was sitting with Janice in the audience. Although he'd seen Nicole only twice since their time together in New York, once he'd flown to Erie and the other time she'd met him after a performance in Ann Arbor, they were talking and texting regularly. When he'd called to tell her that David Talbot of 60 Minutes told him the show wanted to film him performing with the legendary Ricardo Muti, Nicole had screamed and actually dropped her phone. When she'd picked it up and called him back, she'd asked him,
Can I do anything? I know you must have everything set up, but if I can help, I'd love to. Want me to pick up your dry cleaning?
I want you to come, he'd said impulsively. I can get you a ticket.
Will you?
It would really mean a lot to me. Both Janice and Nicole had asked if he wanted them backstage, and he said of course they should sit in the audience. He got free tickets, and someone should use them. Now he regretted it. Should he ask them to come back now? No, of course not. There wasn't time. More than anything else, he worried about letting everyone down. Nicole, Anderson Cooper, Grandma Nora, and especially Janice, who had called in every favor she had to get him here. What if his bow slipped? What if his harmonics didn't sound? Or worse, what if his coordination was just off? What if he just played notes instead of making music? He called Janice.
Is everything all right? Where are you?
Her words were a little hard to hear above the hum of the crowd.
Everything's fine, he said, unconvinced.
It's Ray, he heard Janice saying, probably to Nicole. I just called to say thanks for everything. And then unprompted,
I'm just so worried about screwing up tonight.
The silence stretched. Had she hung up? But then her voice poured over the line, golden.
What was that piece you auditioned with?
What are you talking about?
When you were in high school, you played Vivaldi, right?
Why are you bringing that up now?
Because I think you should remember it yourself. You were so nervous and you outplayed everyone on that rental instrument, remember?
Yeah, I remember. I had no training. I was a mess.
You were a seriously talented mess, she said. It wasn't your grandmother's violin that got you here. It's your own talent. Remember that, okay? And remember why you're doing this.
Her words echoed between them, and he found that he could take a breath, and then another. He could hear Nicole's voice in Janice's phone.
Can I talk to him?
And a moment later,
Ray, what did you eat at that Indian restaurant we went to after the Carnegie Hall performance?
Huh?
What?
Vegetable tikka masala. Why?
You're the only guy I've ever met who can casually eat vegetable tikka masala after totally slaying them in Carnegie Hall. And now you're playing with the Chicago Symphony. You totally got this.
Janice took the phone back.
Just remember how much you love playing. That's all you need to do. Stand up there and hold that amazing gift your grandmother gave you, and just love the music you're playing.
Nicole is right.
You've got this.
For a moment, Anderson Cooper wasn't outside, and Ricardo Muti wasn't conducting the Chicago Symphony 50 feet away.
I'm glad I called.
I'm glad you called, too. We'll see you after the performance, okay?
The monitor in the dressing room showed he had 6 minutes till he had to be on stage.
Only 6 minutes?
Would his mother watch when it aired? Would she be proud of him? Would she even know? One more check in the mirror. He lifted the violin from its case, triple-checked to see if it was in tune, played a quick G major scale. He picked the pink rose out of its glass of water, opened the door, and walked out into the lights. A week before Christmas, the 60 Minutes piece ran. He was the final segment.
Janice, I just saw your face on my TV.
Aunt Rochelle,
sugar, this is so exciting.
And dozens of others who'd seen the teasers and were sitting at home waiting. He was in Erie holding Nicole's hand, about to watch himself on her TV, while a half dozen of her friends and a couple other orchestra members perched on chairs leaned against the walls or sat cross-legged on the floor. He'd had no performances booked for most of December and had spent the time in Erie with Nicole. When he'd learned the air date of his segment, Nicole asked if she could throw him a watch party. It was a chance to meet her friends, too. So he agreed. The trademark ticking clock of 60 minutes, 7:42 p.m. Anderson Cooper's face, and Ray recognized the background. The Chicago Symphony Auditorium, lights ablaze, seats empty. When you think of classical music, Anderson Cooper began, you might think of bewigged men in frock coats, playing to ladies in hoop skirts in 19th century drawing rooms. Nothing could be further from the truth today. And there was Ray's face on the screen, eyes closed, violin uplifted, playing the Mendelssohn Concerto. The camera panned back. The tuxedo twinkled. Ray McMillan, his full name is Raekwon, but don't ever call him that, is one of the most unlikely musicians today, Anderson Cooper said. It's hard to understand his rise to stardom. Most musicians who are in the top ranks learn classical music from a very early age, with private lessons and special tutors. They go to rarefied schools like Juilliard or the Manhattan School of Music. Most of them are not people of color. Ray is an exception. The piece went on, talking about how Janice had offered him a music scholarship, about how his single-minded devotion made him the top violinist at Markham University, playing doggedly on a beat-up fiddle that his grandmother had given him. Cut to Anderson Cooper's interview with Janice as they walked around the Markham grounds. Anderson went on. What makes Ray even rarer is that he's black. Go look at any orchestra in any city in America, and you'll see the faces on stage are overwhelmingly white. Close-up shots of various symphonies, of white musicians. In fact, in all major American orchestras, only 1.8% of musicians are black. The number jumps to about 12% if you include all people of color. Ray's story is unique only because he's more talented and more single-minded than many others, and he found a teacher who nourished and supported him. The crowd in Nicole's apartment roared with sympathetic laughter, clapping Ray on the back or high-fiving him. Cut to a heavyset guy walking down a Charlotte street. Ray didn't recognize him.
Yeah. Ray and me were buddies, the guy said. His voice sounded familiar. We bonded over the violin. That guy couldn't get enough of it. He loved it. I used to give him pointers.
Anderson Cooper's voiceover. Growing up, he had few friends except Mark Jennings, another violinist in orchestra, who told us how devoted and disciplined Ray always was. Mark Jennings? The racist? Before Ray even had a chance to process this, the piece was moving on. And then something unlikely, one of the most extraordinary events in recent music history, occurred. You've probably heard the story since it made headlines. It turns out that the old fiddle he played, the one his grandma had given him, was actually one of the rarest instruments ever made. A Stradivarius violin. Shots of Cremona, a brief discussion of Stradivarius violins. Experts tell us that Antonio Stradivari made about 650 violins, but only 244 have been accounted for. Make that 245. Interview with Ray, which he'd done in the Chicago Symphony dressing room, trying to look relaxed and calm, with the lights glaring in his face, and Anderson Cooper sitting across from him asking questions. The makeup woman had to stop the interview several times to blot at the sweat on Ray's hairline. Afterward, under his tuxedo jacket, his pink shirt had been soaked. The violin is valued at somewhere between $10 and $12 million, Anderson went on. It's a Cinderella story, or it should be. Instead, Ray McMillan has found himself mired in lawsuits contesting his ownership of the violin. The first is from his family, who believe that the violin should rightfully belong to them. Shot of four people, Thurston, Larry, Joyce, and his mom, sitting in what Ray recognized as Joyce's living room.
That fiddle was my mama's, Thurston said. It's been in our family for 100 years. It should have been ours, not Ray's.
Joyce said,
Mama didn't really know what she had. We think she may have had dementia. If she'd known what it was, she would never have given it to him. And the Ray I knew and watched grow up would never have done this to us. He's really changed in the last few years.
Thurston, Joyce, and Larry sat uncomfortably on Joyce's brown sectional couch. Ray's mother, in a yellow mini dress, was perched on a faded tan armchair next to them. Anderson Cooper asked, So you think all this new fame has gone to his head?
You damn right it has, Larry said.
Thurston said,
Our mother would tell us stories of how her grandfather would play that fiddle and how one day it would be passed down to us. Ray knew that. All we want is for him to do what's right.
Cut to Anderson Cooper. And so Ray's family filed a lawsuit against him, claiming that the violin is rightfully theirs. They didn't know, however, that another family also has a prior claim to the instrument, the Marx family. The Marx family are descendants of the slave owners who owned Ray's great-great-grandfather. Ray's family maintains that Thomas Marx gave the violin to their great-grandfather and that it has remained in their possession ever since.
Cut back to Anderson, now on stage in the symphony auditorium. Dramatic pause. The Marx family, however, disagrees. A familiar man and woman filled the screen, walking down a garden path. Andrea and Dante Marx maintain that the violin is theirs and that their ancestor never gave the violin away. They're suing Ray to get the violin back. Ray found himself standing. He'd been holding Nicole's hand, leaning forward, and now he clenched his fists, unable to breathe. Andrea Marx, gray-haired, gray-eyed, said earnestly into the camera, "We feel for Mr. McMillan. We do." The makeup and the lighting made her look hard and gleaming, like polished steel. "It's just that this was our property." The Marxes have filed their own lawsuit, claiming that the violin belongs to them, not to Ray or his family. The Marx family immigrated to America in the late 18th century, Anderson went on, where they built Summerlin Manor outside Milledgeville, Georgia. They farmed 3,000 acres. They grew cotton, corn, tobacco, and wheat. They owned many musical instruments, including a violin from Cremona, Italy. And they enslaved, at the height of their economic prosperity, 172 human beings, including Leon, who may have been the natural son of the plantation owner and who was Ray's grandmother's grandfather.
"We thought the violin went missing during Sherman's march to the sea," Dante said. "But when we heard about the violin that Mr. McMillan is playing, we realized it was our family's."
"Did you reach out to Ray?" Anderson Cooper asked.
The brother said, "We did. We surely did."
"He wasn't interested in talking to us," the sister said.
Cut to Anderson Cooper. "So what are you going to do? Are you going to sue Ray for the instrument?"
"We don't want to," Dante said.
He and Andrea were now sitting on a garden bench, dark green bushes massing behind them. The sky was a clear pearl gray. "Seems to me that you didn't even notice the violin was gone," Anderson Cooper said. "And meanwhile, it's been a godsend to Ray McMillan, a gift from his beloved grandmother."
"It's not his," said the sister. "His family somehow appropriated it during the war, during Sherman's march, or afterward, during the emancipation."
"Does it feel a little awkward asking the descendant of a man your family once owned to give back your property? After all, there are those who would say the violin is a means of compensating Black Americans for what they suffered as slaves. That even if Ray's ancestor did take the violin, he and his family are actually owed much more by your family. That it's from his family's labor that your family was able to prosper. It's even possible that Ray's family actually built Summerlin Manor to begin with." Again, the shot of the brick mansion.
"Well, I don't know about that," the sister said. "It's ours, and we're glad to come to a settlement arrangement for it."
Back again to Anderson Cooper, standing in the empty Chicago Symphony Auditorium, and then a voiceover as Ray silently played on stage. "And that's where things stand today," came Anderson Cooper's voice. "A priceless violin, a battle over its heritage, and a Black musician who, more than anything else, just wants to play it." Ray faded from the screen, and the ticking clock returned. 7:55 p.m. Around him, the room erupted in shouts. People, he was barely aware of who they were, trying to hug him, telling him what an amazing piece that was, how great he looked. Calls, Janice, Aunt Rochelle, others, were coming in. He shook everyone off, slid out of the living room and into the small bathroom off the kitchen, shut the door behind him, sat down on the closed toilet seat lid, and took out his phone. He thumbed through his email, found Kim Wach, associate of Mendel, Panofsky & Levine, 666 Fifth Avenue. "Hi, Kim. I don't know if you saw the 60 Minutes piece that just aired about me, but it sure doesn't look like the Marxes are going away. Can you call me ASAP?" He put his head between his legs, trembling, sat up, Next to him, in a pile on a shelf, rested several random magazines. People, Cosmopolitan, Men's Health. He pulled down the Men's Health, opened it blindly. A knock on the door.
Ray?
Nicole's voice.
Hey, you okay?
He returned to the party, tried to smile and join in the celebration, but his stomach churned with nausea. Next day, Kim Watt gave him a call.
They're going to try playing this in the media, clearly. I heard from the lawyer yesterday that they're getting ready to file the case in federal court. He said that they have more evidence, but he hasn't sent it over to me yet. The lawyer insinuated that they'll just keep grinding you down until you give in.
Yeah, that's what I thought, he said.
And you still weren't able to track down anything from your family,
Kim said. They're not speaking to me now, he said. They're filing a suit against me, too.
What about your cousins?
He'd reached out to distant cousins. They knew nothing about any envelope with the name Leon Marks written on it, and didn't know anything about the violin.
Let's see what the Marks' evidence is, she said. Maybe it's not that bad.
They hung up, and he tried to hold on to the hope that things weren't that bad, that everything would work out. Maybe the Marxes would just slither back under their flat rock, or maybe not.
Chapter 22. Boston, 4 months ago. The 60 Minutes interview, coupled with the Chicago performance, generated invites from orchestras across the United States. His star was definitely on the rise. He was starting to make money and was saving every penny, terrified of the upcoming legal bills from two lawsuits. He should just cut the violin in half and give each of them their own piece. Just keep the alligator skin case for himself. Nobody except him cared anything about the violin. To them, it was a dollar sign, or a sign of prestige. He tried to tell himself that it was just a precision instrument, chunks of wood carved and glued together. And yet sometimes, no, often as he was playing, it felt like it wasn't just him playing. It was the instrument itself, singing with joy and yes, with gratitude, grateful to him, grateful to the world. How could he betray it? He flew to Boston for a recital in Jordan Hall on the campus of the New England Conservatory of Music, playing Dvorak and Mozart. He was especially happy with his performance of Dvorak's Romance in F Minor. The piece grew on him the more he performed it, reminding him of taking walks in the summertime with Grandma Nora, the Georgia heat thick and soft against his skin. He felt like she would have loved the piece. After the performance was over, he ducked out the back entrance. He was tired and very hungry. He definitely needed to schedule his recitals earlier in the evening. The cold night air cut through his shirt and jacket. He put on the large sweatshirt he'd brought. He should have packed a better overcoat, but the sweatshirt was easier to fold and more portable. He pulled up the hood, but it didn't help. It started snowing. Welcome to Boston. The wind attacked like a hawk after a mouse. He'd heard Aunt Rochelle say when he'd visited her in Philly,
"Ooh-wee, that hawk is biting," when the wind would drive into their faces.
Now he understood the hawk was certainly biting tonight. He pulled his black baseball cap farther down over his face. Definitely doing Boston recitals in the summertime from now on. A diner beckoned, perfumed with the scent of roasting meats and grilled onion. He thought of sitting at the counter, but decided to eat back at the hotel.
"What you having, hon?"
said the thick-waisted, thick-accented woman at the counter. He ordered tater tots, Cobb salad, and a slice of apple pie to go. While he waited, he called Nicole. He hadn't talked to her since early that afternoon, and he wondered how her own performance that evening had gone. She was playing a chamber music recital, Brandenburg Concerto No. 6,
which featured two viola soloists. She'd been very excited about the performance, and he regretted having to miss it. But she didn't pick up. His call went straight to voicemail.
Hey, my recital went well. How did yours go? Did the cellist get the rhythm right?
I'm going to get something to eat before I head back to the hotel. I'll call you later. A few minutes later, takeout bag in hand, he shouldered open the diner's door, and the cold Boston night blew around him. He wasn't really aware of the people standing outside on the sidewalk until one of them spoke. The voice was terrifyingly familiar, high yet gravelly.
That was just the most amazing performance I think I've ever heard.
Dante Marks and his sister stood not 5 feet away, their hands in their pockets, their eyes bright beneath ski caps pulled low across their foreheads. Behind them was a very tall man wearing a tan overcoat. He kept looking left, then right, then at Ray.
What the? You did such a fine job tonight, Andrea said.
She sounded earnest, but he somehow thought she was mocking him.
Why are you here?
Are you following me?
We know you're off and traveling, so we just wanted to see for ourselves that you're taking good care of our violin, Dante explained.
Heat surged through Ray. Our violin. The words lay on the pavement, cold and dead, like something run over. He took a step forward.
I don't know what drugs you two freaks are doing that make you think you can follow me around, but let me make it clear to you. This is my violin. I'll say it again, my violin. It belonged to my great-great-grandfather, and now it's mine. You're out of your fucking minds if you think you're getting your dirty fingers on it.
Rayquis, or whatever the hell your name is, Andrea said, we are getting that violin back. If you think you have a chance in hell of keeping it, you better think again.
The tall man loomed over all of them, glancing around as if waiting for something.
You know damn well what my name is, lady. If you think I'm giving you my violin, our violin, Dante said. See, we tried to be nice and give you a chance to give back our violin without getting lawyers involved. But you had to try to be Billy Badass and act all tough. You're not gonna win this one.
Our violin. Ray could hear only those two words. Something cut loose inside him, and he was suddenly yelling,
Shut your fucking mouth! I swear, if you say our violin one more fucking time, I won't be responsible for what happens next. Your rapist great-great-great-grandfather gave that fiddle to my pop-pop. He didn't steal from you or anyone else. If it was so important to you, why the fuck didn't you try to get it back 30 years ago?
Passers-by turned to look at him. He didn't care. Both Dante and Andrea seemed, maddeningly, to be smiling. The tall man looked off to the right, behind Ray.
Stay the hell away from me. If I see you again, I swear the cops what?
A deep, thick Boston accent said behind him. And another voice.
What's going on over here?
Ray turned. Two big-bellied police officers, hands on their belts, stood splay-legged on the sidewalk. Steam seemed to snake from their nostrils and form a plume above their heads. The one on the left was in his 50s, a little heavier, with a clean-shaven face that looked scraped raw. The one on the right was younger, with a thin dark mustache and the promising beginnings of a paunch to rival his partner's.
Officers, thank goodness you're here, Andrea said.
Ray would have sworn she batted her eyelashes like some kind of geriatric Miss America contestant.
We were simply asking this young man to return some property when he started threatening us.
What? Ray said. That's not... You got some ID, the cop on the left said.
Ray let out a breath. Officer, this isn't what it looks like. These people are basically stalkers. They showed up at my house.
They showed up here and...
ID now, the older officer said.
He shifted his hand from his belt to his holster. Dante's smile broadened. Ray glared at both Marxes as he reached for his wallet.
Whoa there, chief. Slowly,
said the younger cop. My name is Ray McMillan. I'm a concert violinist. See, this is my violin. I'm here from out of town, and I'm just trying to get some dinner before I go back to my hotel.
I didn't ask you any of that, Chief. I just need to see some ID now.
I'm going to reach into my back pocket, okay? Slowly, he reached into his back pocket and pulled out his wallet. He was fumbling for his driver's license as another police car pulled up. Several bystanders and people inside the diner held up their phones, filming him.
Thank goodness you showed up when you did, officer,
Andrea gushed, as if she had just been rescued from a serial rapist.
I was worried he was about to get violent.
Fuck you, Ray said to her.
You see, officer, all we want is for him to return some property that belongs to us, and he goes off and calls us names and threatens us.
I need you to put your hands behind your back while my partner runs your name to see what your deal is, the older cop said.
What?
See what my deal is? You don't ask these three nutcases for their IDs. I didn't threaten them. Why am I being cuffed?
Because you are being very aggressive, and these people seem to fear for their safety. Now put your hands behind your back.
Oh, I get it. Angry black man, dangerous, protect innocent white folk. This is bull. I suggest for your own good that you keep your mouth shut. Metal cuffs, warmed from the police officer's body, curled and wrapped around Ray's wrists. Nervously, he kept reaching up with a finger or two to touch the violin case on his back, as if he needed extra reassurance that it was still there. The younger officer took Ray's wallet and retrieved his driver's license. Two more patrol cars pulled up.
Gentlemen, ma'am, why don't you go inside and give this officer a statement while we check this guy out?
Thank you, officer. Come, my dear. Are you okay?
Dante asked his sister, and then smiled toothily at Ray. He stood in the cold as the Mark siblings and their tall companion were coddled in the diner, probably ordering coffee and onion rings. Ray kept touching the violin case to make sure it was closed. Inside, Dante, Andrea, and the tall man were talking to the younger officer, pointing and glaring at Ray. A few moments later, the police officer came out of the diner.
Those people claim you have their stolen property. What's that on your back?
The officer stepped forward. Ray's fingertips instinctively reached for the case.
It's my violin. I'm a musician. I was just on 60 Minutes. Go Google me. My name is...
Open it up. Let me see.
Take off these cuffs and I will.
He was trembling from rage and impotence. He kept saying to himself that one word over and over, his mantra. Respect. No matter what. He'd gone overboard with the Marxes. Right now, he just had to get out of this situation before it escalated further, became Baton Rouge all over again.
Officer, I'm a musician. I just played a recital at Jordan Hall. My violin is inside. I don't want to take it out on the sidewalk. Exposure to this cold isn't good for it. It's very fragile and very valuable.
Got it, said the fat cop. Open up the case, sir, or we can do this down at the station.
Okay, Ray said. Take off these cuffs, and I'll open it right up.
Let me just confirm, though, that you want me to open a $10 million instrument in the middle of a city street while it's snowing?
A few fat flakes drifted down.
Are you sure that Boston wants this kind of lawsuit if something goes wrong? Not to mention the publicity? This violin costs more than your whole department. I just want you to confirm this first, Chief.
The cop eyed him, then the diner.
I guess we can go inside if you don't interact with the individuals who are already there.
Sounds great, Ray said. He stood, handcuffed in front of the glass and metal door, waited for the cop to pull the door open. He waited again at the inner door. Dante, Andrea, and the tall guy were standing near the counter,
and they all stepped back as if terrified to be in the same space with Ray.
Oh, please, Ray told them. Spare us the dramatics. You're not getting my violin.
It took me a minute, but I figured out what you were trying to do. It's not going to work.
I'm sure I don't know what you are talking about, Andrea said, her accent suddenly thick and southern and nothing like her usual voice.
Ray marched left, between a double row of maroon booths that ran the length of the restaurant. All the patrons were turning to look at him, handcuffed and flanked by three of Boston's finest. At the far end, in front of a busing station, where dirty plates poured from black plastic tubs, he said,
If you'll remove these cuffs, I'll show you the violin.
The police officer grabbed Ray's arm, fumbling with the cuffs, and one of the other officers strolled up.
This guy checks out. No warrants.
Looks like it's your lucky day, Chief.
The handcuffs fell away, and Ray ostentatiously massaged his wrists as if they'd cut off his circulation for hours. The cop was saying,
Now, these people say you have their property. Can you prove that instrument is yours?
Ray looked at the cop like he had just grown an extra head. Are you fucking kidding me? I literally just told you I played a recital at Jordan Hall.
And I just told you to prove it.
Ray knew the look in the police officer's eyes. The man was looking for any excuse to take him down to the police station.
Well, it's nice to know you guys are consistent. These people stalk me, accost me out in the cold, pretend I'm about to beat them up, and here you guys come to the rescue.
The darkest one in the crowd has got to be the guilty one. I have to prove my innocence while they just sit inside and need protecting, right? That's how this works.
You got it, Chief, the fat cop responded, to Ray's surprise. Right now, they look far more credible than you do. Your next move better be showing me what's in that case. Otherwise, I'll be confiscating it until you prove to a judge that it doesn't belong to these nice people.
Ray unclasped his case. As he took out the instrument and the bow, he asked the younger cop, You have any requests?
Just play, smartass.
Right, Ray said, as he continued to stare daggers at the Marxes and their accomplice. Ray put his bow on the D string and looked as if he were preparing to launch into the most lavish concerto ever written. Instead, he played a 2-octave D major scale. It was nothing special, just a simple scale, but played beautifully. After his last note, he looked directly at the Marxes and said, You don't deserve to hear another note from my fiddle. Then he turned to the officer and said, Satisfied?
I can show you dozens of photos online of me playing this violin, Ray said. I can call dozens of people to vouch for me.
Just Google my name. This time, the officers listened, pulled out their cell phones, read, glanced up at him, read again.
This is the Stradivarius, the younger one said. Holy shit.
Yeah, Ray said. It's mine. These nutjobs have come up with some crazy idea that it's theirs, but they're just lying. He spoke loud enough to be heard at the counter. Andrea rose to the bait.
We are not, she yelled back. It's our family heirloom. Our niece is going to play it someday.
But she sounded hopeless and definitely crazy.
Ma'am, sir,
you're going to have to take him to court for this one, the older cop said. I don't think any of you are in any physical danger. If you have further issues, we can take this down to the station.
The Marxists shook their heads, and soon the police officers left. The tall goon behind them still hadn't said anything. The people in the diner and the people outside continued to hold up their phones, filming them. As Ray packed up the violin, Andrea inched over to him. Hissed,
Don't think this is over. We tried to let you off easy.
Lady, go home. Stay out of my face. You'll be hearing from my attorney. He was so angry that he left the diner without taking his tater tots, salad, and pie.
Now the Boston Hawk didn't seem nearly as cold.